You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Like many Park City teenagers, Matthew Prince was once a ski instructor at Park City Mountain Resort. But not many such teenagers go on to have the kind of career Matthew Prince has had, building Cloudflare. It's a leading global connectivities cloud company that was ranked number 14 on the Fortune 50 list in 2024. We're lucky to be joined by him to discuss his career path and some of what he sees for Park City's future. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you were a youngster here in Park City. What was the town like then, and what was it like to be a ski instructor?
Yeah, I grew up between Park City and Salt Lake, and I just loved it up here. This was always what I identified as home. I remember going, my favorite Mexican place was Utah Coal and Lumber, which is now Courchevel. I have a scar on my forehead from when I was 3 years old and toddled into the eating establishment, tripped on the doorstop, fell, bled like crazy. My parents were like, just get a dish towel, wrap it around your head, you'll be fine. And it was fun. My parents used to say, go out and don't come home until you find a moose. And it was back in the day, before cell phones, before anything else. And I remember just wandering out being like, I guess we got to go find a moose. And we'd often just sleep out, up somewhere up in what is, today Jupiter Bowl, and, wander home in the morning when we got hungry. And it's just a really special place to grow up.
And we're going to come back to talk more about Vail and Park City Resort, but talk a little bit about what it was like working at the ski resort at that time.
Yeah, so I went to college, and I had gotten admitted to law school, and originally was planning to, I had a friend who we were going to travel around the world, his mom got really sick, and so he wasn't able to go. And I was too chicken to do it by myself. And so on a lark, I applied to Deer Valley, Park City, and got a job at Park City. And it was one of those just sort of epic winters where we started skiing at the beginning of November. A lot of people who are still up at the mountain were the people who were my mentors and guides. And it was just great. It was like I taught mostly 3 to 9 year olds. I've never been puked and peed on more in my life, even as a dad, than I was over that year. But I think it was really good and just sort of a humbling experience. It was good to know that I had somewhere to go next. But I think especially as a father now, I think about it all the time, about when I'm trying to figure out how to negotiate with my 3 year old. I remember back to the weekly lessons with folks and little kids, and it was just a really, really, really magical experience.
But ultimately, you did end up going to law school, and after law school, you didn't really want to stay being a lawyer. How come?
Yeah, I actually went and worked at your old firm, Latham & Watkins.
Maybe that's the reason. Anyway,
yeah, go ahead. I was a summer intern there in 1999. And in the San Francisco office, and over the course of that one summer, I worked on 6 different IPOs, all these tech companies. And I remember, I'd been pretty good at computers as a kid, and I thought, I'm not sure I really want to be a lawyer for the rest of my life, but maybe I could work really hard, at the firm, do sort of 6 years of work here, find a really great company, have them, help them go public, and then maybe go in-house and work for them. And I thought that would be kind of a really, really fun path. And then went back, got an offer to go full-time, went back to school, and remember in March of 2000 getting a call from the head of the placement at Latham, and she said, good news, bad news. Good news, unlike a lot of your classmates, you still have a job, because it was the dot-com burst. And Latham actually at that time was one of the few firms that actually kept all their summer associates around. That changed the next financial crisis. But bad news, we don't need any securities lawyers, but we have lots of room in the bankruptcy practice. And it's basically the same thing, which is something that only a lawyer would ever say. And if you if your goal was to go get a job at what your client was, being a bankruptcy lawyer wasn't a very good strategy because your client didn't exist for long afterwards. And I remember just thinking, what am I going to do? And so I ended up having to pay back, I turned down the offer at Latham, paid back the signing bonus, which was the biggest check by far I'd written in my life. And actually went to work for a small startup. And
was that Unspam?
No, it was a firm called GroupWorks. It was a online. It was the most boring company in the world, but it was an online benefits broker. One of my law school professor's brothers was starting it, and they said, "We'll match your salary, and we'll give you this thing called stock." And I was like, "Okay, that sounds great." And so I went, and I remember we raised $6 million. I was the first employee. There were the founders who were there as well, but I was the first non-founder employee. And we screwed up in every possible way. It was a complete and total disaster of a company. And yet the idea that we could take what was a blank sheet of paper and create something, or at least try to, and then, you know, fail, but fail honorably, and like no one went to jail, which again, if you lose $6 million of someone's money, I mean, it seemed unfathomable to me. And the investors were like, "Hey, good try. If you're ever starting something again, give us a call." And I was like, "Wow, this is a really interesting kind of world." And from that point in time, I was pretty hooked.
Nice. So then when did Unspam come along?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was sort of like I'd sort of found this really intoxicating drug, and I was searching for it somewhere, but I still had to pay the bills. So I worked as a bartender in Chicago for a while. I was an LSAT test prep instructor. I taught some law school that was so bad that it doesn't exist anymore into making me an adjunct professor there. And so I was kind of doing all of these other things around the side, and I started at the time. What today would be known as a blog, but this was back in 2001, 2002. I don't even know the term had been coined. And I was really interested in this question of, you know, for the first time in human history, really, there were some examples of things like mail fraud. But for the most part, if you committed crime, there had to be some proximity to wherever you were. And so we have written all this stuff. Roger's laughing. So, if you can't see this here, but this is a thing that only lawyers would find interesting. But this idea that jurisdiction and the internet were very complicated, and I got particularly sort of obsessed with this idea of, you know, you could send an email and commit a crime in some other place and not even know you were committing that crime. And how could you think about that problem? How could you solve that problem? And I wrote a bunch of law review articles and things on it, and a bunch of things like that. And what happened was, actually it was Chuck Schumer, Senator Schumer's office, a woman, I think her name is Cynthia, there was a staffer in Chuck Schumer's office, called me and said, "Hey, we've been reading your website, blog, and the senator's very interested in doing something around spam. Would you come out and think about, you know, how we could write federal law around this?" And helped write what's now known as the Can-Spam Act. And as part of that, one of the things that was a piece of it was they wanted to do something like the do not call list, but for email. And nobody quite knew how to do that. And I had enough of a technology background. I was like, "Here's how you do it if you wanted to do it." And that idea actually got passed in the federal level, never got implemented, but a bunch of states followed along with that. So Michigan and actually Utah did it as well. And they would call us in, and they'd call me in and say, "Hey, can you explain how we do this?" And the next thing you knew, it had a little like consulting firm that we gave a name to, which was Unspam. Another friend of mine was another lawyer, had been let go from Cooley, another law firm. And so the two of us were kind of running around doing consulting firms. And then the next thing you knew, a couple of states said, "Why don't you actually go build the technology to implement this?" And so we actually set up shop here in Park City, Utah. And Unspam Technologies was me. It was three of us who'd known each other as kids and played in these hills. And we started what started as a little consulting firm and then kind of built a little technology firm along the side. And that was Unspam. And Unspam actually still exists to this day, although it's sort of had a much more moderate level of success.
And then you decided to go back to business school. How come?
Well, I mean, so first of all, you know, I think Unspam was, it was fascinating because we, first of all, it was very hard. I was like, "Well, we're going to base it in Park City because I like to ski, and we'll give all of our employees season passes. And if we'll have a rule that if it snows more than 6 inches, we'll shut the office down. We'll all go skiing." And And it was just like, it was really tough to get engineers to want to live in Park City for lots and lots of reasons. It was an expensive place, even back then, to live. It was a difficult place for a bunch of geeky, largely dudes to be single. And it was just it was tough. But we attracted this really special group of people, and it was fun. And we would keep them engaged with a bunch of things along the side. So we predicted the winners of the Sundance Film Festival in advance using what today we'd call AI, but back at the time we just called Bayesian statistical analysis. We built a browser plugin that was before Google had all these different things. When Google was just search, it would basically like rotate your Google cookie with other people. Well, the idea was it's really hard to not have Google have signal. Like if you search for, you know, Oreo cookie prices, they know you're looking for Oreo cookies. But if you have that then mixed with a whole bunch of other people, it's very hard for them to target you in particular. And so we would basically rotate that around. And then we also built this thing called Project Honeypot, which was basically built for a conference that I was going to go speak at. A guy named Lee Holloway, who was on our team, who lived on Park Ave, for a while lived in my basement and then lived on Park Avenue. He and I built this thing that would essentially track how bad guys, how spammers and other online miscreants would steal your email address. And I presented at the conference. We sort of put it in the corner and completely forgot about it. It was just this kind of fun project to keep our engineering team occupied. And Unspam limped along. It was not a great business. And my dad, who you know was very involved in Park City in a lot of ways, he used to own all of Lower Main Street with a couple of other partners. Actually, got arrested at one point for blocking Lower Main because he wanted to make it more pedestrian accessible. So that fight's been going on for a long time. Put the Alpine Slide in over at Park City. He was getting older and he had a bunch of restaurants, and they were not great restaurants. To give you sort of flavor, he had the only Hooters in Utah, and which was in I think Midvale. And he was like, "Son, you know, I provided for you. It's time for you to come take over the family business." And I couldn't imagine anything I wanted to do less than run my father's Hooters. And so I was desperate to figure anything out. And Unspam was flailing, and I didn't have any other plans, and I didn't have a lot of money. And so after a bottle or maybe two of wine one night, applied to 8 different business schools, was rejected from 7 of them, but somehow got into HBS, which is the Harvard Business School, and called my dad. And I was like, "Hey, so sorry, can't take over the businesses right now. I'm going to have to go to business school." And so, and he's like, "Yeah, that's probably a good idea. You know, go learn how accounting works and things like that." And so I went off to business school and then spent the entire time there trying to figure out something that would be successful enough I didn't have to take over the Hooters.
And a lot of people do that. I mean, some people go to HBS and they are destined to go the traditional path, the equivalent of big law. They're going to go to big consulting.
Yep.
They're going to go to big accounting. That's not what you did.
No, it was never
what you wanted to do, was it?
No, I mean, I just didn't want to run my dad's business. I had the bug of entrepreneurship. I'd seen it up close. I hadn't seen success with it in any way, but it's just really quite amazing to see that, again, you can start with nothing and build something that can solve a really big problem and become a really big business over time. And I met, there was a classmate of mine, a woman named Michelle Zatlin. And Michelle, first I was like, "Michelle's just doing business school wrong." Like everybody in business school, the idea is you raise your hand, you try and make the smart point no one has ever heard before. And Michelle was the person who would raise her hand and say, "Hey, I just want to take it back to what Ashley was saying a couple of those comments ago, because that was really interesting. I'd like to hear more about that. So could Ashley say something more?" And I'm like, "Michelle, that's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be making the really smart point." But she was just, Michelle has ego and sort of a Freudian sense of ego. There's a sense of right and wrong in the world, but she has no vanity. And I think people who are that way are some of the just best people in the world. And so I spent a huge amount of time at business school just being like, "We have to do something together." And Michelle was, I'd pitch her an idea and I'd say, "You know, we should do this." And most of my ideas were some legal scheme to largely try and tax Google. because Google had lots of money, so of course you should try and tax them. And she would just say, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to do something where if I look at myself in the mirror, I'm going to be proud of what we've done. And at some point, I told her about what Lee and I had built with Project Honeypot. And she's like, why? She kept saying, like, why do people sign up for this? It's a pain. If they don't get anything out of it, why would anyone spend the time to do it? And I got frustrated. At some point, I said, Michelle, because at some point, they want us to stop the bad guys, not just track them. And she was like, that's the idea. Let's build that. And so we started that. It was a school project. Lee was still working at Unspam, and he was sort of was moonlighting, helping us build an initial prototype. Michelle and I were plucky business students. She wrote me an email on, like, here are the things I want to get out of this. Here are the things I don't want to get out of it. And we sort of pitched the idea. We ended up winning a business plan competition at Harvard, and then moved out to the Bay Area, which is where Lee was living at the time. He'd gotten married and moved out there, and then it's just been a whirlwind ever since. And that's what Cloudflare is.
So Cloudflare is almost like the prototypical business school concept come to life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's prototypical. There aren't a ton of those.
No. But you hear the stories about Bezos and Amazon was a B school project. I think that's true, isn't it?
I mean, he had gone off and was working at Jane Street, I think.
Right.
But I think he had thought about it some of the time when he was at school.
So prototypical is not the right word because of the degree of success. But I'm trying to think of the right word. But it is almost the legendary sort of kind of thing you hear about a business school project that turns into a major corporation.
I think that some of this is just the consequences of timing. And some of it had terrible timing. Like I graduated from law school right at 2000 when the economy was collapsing and tech was imploding. I graduated from business school in 2009, right when everyone had withdrawn their jobs. Michelle had worked at Google as an intern over the summer. Had Google not withdrawn all their job offers for the summer internships, Cloudflare wouldn't exist because there's no way I would have done it without her.
Now, how'd you find your market for Cloudflare?
I mean, to some extent, we knew it from Project Honeypot. So really the roots of Cloudflare stem back to Park City. Project Honeypot we built here in Park City on a couch on Crescent Ridge over near the Silver Star kind of development in that area. I had my father had an apartment there, and I was basically crashing on it. In it, and Lee and I sat and wrote this, and we put this thing out there that was allowed anyone who was putting content online to track what bad guys were doing, and we just were trying to get enough information to present at this conference, and what we didn't know is that over the course of time we had hundreds of thousands of people sign up for it, and so when we said, okay, we're going to go build Cloudflare. We just took that list that we had of those hundreds of thousands of web administrators and said, hey, we're the team that built Project Honeypot. Thank you for being a part of that over all the years. We have a new service that actually helps you stop the bad guys. And would you be interested in trying it out? And those early adopters, I mean, I still get emails from the people who 15 years ago, made a bet to sign up with us and trusted us on it. We were obviously much more sophisticated today, but those, we really built the business on those early adopters.
We're lucky enough to read a lot of books that deal with the evolution of companies. And this one's particularly interesting to me because in a way you walked into it with a potential customer mailing list. That's an extraordinary, mm-hmm. I mean, and it really worked for you in that sense. That's unusual.
Yeah, the one word I might quibble with in that is customer.
A potential customer.
Well, because early on, one of the things that was like, we weren't doing it. We were, for the most part, when someone would sign up for Cloudflare in the early days, every site, for the first 10, 20 sites, we would break them in terrible, horrible ways. And then we'd iterate and learn and fix it. And so it was a free service, and they were very apologetic. We were very apologetic, and they were very forgiving to us for what we were doing. And we say try it again, and they were incredibly tolerant of this. But we knew the nature of what we had to do. It was so hard. You had to build this global network where today, you know, we're in 350 cities worldwide. We carry something like, you know, somewhere between 20 and 30% of all of the web's traffic passes through Cloudflare's network. Like, it's an extraordinary responsibility. If we go down, there are planes that can't land. I remember we had an outage several years ago. I was living here in Park City, and my wife was at Fresh Market, and she's like, strangest thing, all the cash registers went down. And I was like, yeah, it was my fault. And she was like, she's like, many things are your fault, but that was probably not it. And I was like, actually, many things are not my fault, but that one was. NCR is a customer, and they are, you know, power the cash registers in town. So
yeah.
So I think that it took us actually a long time to, if a customer is someone who pays you, it actually took us a really long time to have customers. For a long time, we were having what were actually users. And those users were incredibly helpful for us to build what we have today.
So let's take a step back and paint a visual, an audio picture of where Cloudflare sits. So the people, as we're having this conversation, yeah. I think people are wondering, well, wait a minute, where are you in this movie? I mean, when you've got these users, where does it sit in the world, in the web space?
Yeah. So first of all, our customers are not most of your listeners. Our customers are businesses. And those businesses are trying to do something online. And so they're trying to put up a website to advertise like specials that they have at their deli, or they're trying to put up an e-commerce store to sell something online, or they have employees at their business that are trying to go out and use the internet from the business. The internet itself, if you go back to the sort of protocols from the 60s, 70s, 80s that were laid down, like, didn't think about security, didn't think about performance, didn't think about reliability, didn't think about actually cost in any way. And so what Cloudflare is at some level is we're sitting in the middle as an overlay to the internet, making it so that the internet performs the way it should have had we all known what it was going to become. And so the easiest example of this is, let's say that you have a website and you want to make sure that website is safe from hackers. You would hire Cloudflare. We would basically sit as almost like a bodyguard in front of your website. And if someone kind of comes and they're, you know, they're a normal shopper, the bodyguard just lets them right in and it's fine. If on the other hand, they're a Chinese hacker, then the bodyguard sort of shoos them away. And that's entirely what we do, but at a scale which is just extraordinary. Billions of times, you know, every minute. And that's something that is, you know, again, that has been just a very compelling value proposition. But you can the sort of very short sort of description of Cloudflare is we help make the internet faster and protect it from bad guys. Some people say we're like a bodyguard for the internet. I would say we're sort of like what the internet should have been if we'd all known what it was going to become back when we set down those original protocols.
And I think you said this. You actually are involved in a significant percentage of the total, you know, of the total volume on the internet.
Yeah, it depends on how you
measure it,
but we're if you look at just like the number of sites that are out there, between 20% and 30% will use us. A huge percentage of traffic is there, and we run data centers all around the world. The closest one to us here in Park City is down Salt Lake, but wherever you are, if you're in Rwanda, we have one in Kigali. If you're in Pakistan, we have one in. We have actually three in Pakistan. I mean, so everywhere you go around the world, Cloudflare has a presence, and that's how we're able to deliver the performance and security we can anywhere you are.
Wow.
So most, or many startups, you start moving, it starts to work, and then there comes the crisis point where you're not sure you're going to make payroll. Did you guys ever run into one of those where you had the liquidity crisis?
Never. I mean, we were always, you know, I've always just thought that if anyone trusts you with their capital, it has to be, it's just, you have to treat it, you know, with a degree of sacredness that we never got less than half of whatever the last round was in the bank, and we were. You know, we were very frugal. Everyone built their own desks from the beginning. We didn't have lavish. We still don't have lavish sort of Silicon Valley. Like, we don't have a cafeteria with, you know, fancy foods and all kinds of things. I think we're very sort of practical. Michelle, early on, when people would say, you know, what's Cloudflare's culture like? She would say adult like. And I think, you know, which is different than a lot of the sort of stereotypical. We weren't trying to build college. We really thought that. It was that the value was in, you know, how do we deliver more value to our customers than we capture ourselves? And that still, you know, very much pervades the culture at Cloudflare today.
Okay, so Park City, you came back.
Did.
Why?
Well, when I was 17, I moved away from here, and I was like, I'm never coming back uh-huh. to this godforsaken town. And it's amazing. I mean, it's you go and you see a lot of the world, and this is a pretty special place. And so that was important for me.
And how much time are you able to spend here? Are you able to work virtually?
This is our home. My kids are in school. I mean, one of them not old enough to go to school yet, but is in school here. This is home for us. I end up traveling because we have offices around the world, and we end up traveling. And just like a lot of Parkites, you know, mud season isn't my favorite time to be here. So we're going to head out of town for a little bit here, but we'll be back this summer and this fall. And again, this is very much home. I think that for a long time, whenever I'd come to town, I'd just crash in one of my dad's places here. And at some point, I remember back in 2018, he somewhat over dinner unceremoniously announced that he was going to start renting it out. And I was recently married, and Cloudflare had been successful but not wildly successful, and I remember coming back home, and my wife was like, "You're having a pretty emotional reaction to this." And I was like, "Yeah, what about?" And she's like, "You know, you can afford to buy your own place here." And I was like, "Yeah, I can." So we looked around, and you know, we'd always lived kind of around town, but always had really just loved Old Town, and found a place here that we thought was just going to be a ski home for us. And my wife made me swear up, down, left, right, and sideways that this wasn't my midlife crisis, and I was going to force her to move back to Utah. And then she was the one who was like, every weekend, we were living in the Bay Area, which is where Cloudflare is based. And she was every weekend, she's like, "Can we go back? Can we go back? Can we go back?" And so like the folks at Butcher's were like, "Oh, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. You know, must be the princess walking in." Cause we would always kind of come in and get chicken fried steak right at the end of the evening. And then, you know, like COVID happened, and we moved here, and my wife said, "I have to confess, I don't like the Bay Area, and I don't want to go back." And she's from Boston, and I said, mm-hmm. "I don't really like Boston either, and I don't want to go there." And she said, "Well, I guess we're staying here." And so we've been here and made this home since then. But I've lived in Park City on and off for 50 years at this point.
Well, that does set us up to have to ask you a little bit about that house. Was this the house that you currently are working on, or was it another house?
No, so we were here, and in the home that we bought, which is where we live now, it was a great house, but it wasn't really set up for young kids and things mm-hmm. like that. So we said, let's figure out something. So there was two what were used as nightly rentals that were behind us, and we approached the owner and said, "Would you be interested in selling them?" And we came to an agreement. And then have spent quite a long process at this point trying to build what we hope will be our family home. And we care. I mean, I care enormously about Main Street. I want Main Street to succeed. I had an experience as a kid where I got to come out here and, you know, play here and just have a wonderful time. I want that for my kids. And so that's what we're trying to recreate. And we're trying to figure out how can we create a home that can be our permanent home. And do it in a way that, you know, I think is respectful to this and takes what were two nightly rentals and turns them into what is going to be a, you know, single family home for people who are very much committed to the community.
And where does the process of that country's been going on for a while? Where does that stand now?
I don't know. I know you had your own issues with houses. I think one of the things that's we've got to really wrestle with as a community is it's so easy to shut things down here. And so the process was, you know, we initially went to the former planning commission director and said, "Hey, here's what we're thinking." And she was incredibly discouraging. She said, "You're never going to be able to build anything on that lot, no matter how hard you try. And so you should just sell it and move to the colony." And I was just like, that's just depressing. Like, that's just a horror. And again, to get that from like a public official was really depressing. And so we went to the Historic Society. We hired Tom Kundig, who I think is one of the best sort of industrial architects in the world right now. It really inspired by the mines of Spokane. He and his team flew out and got. We actually had the Historic Society tour around all of the old mining structures. We got down to measuring literally how big the boards were on the board form concrete to be able to match that. How large the muttons or mutons are on the windows to be able to match that. And I was really proud that folks like Sally Elliott, folks like the Park City Museum were like, this is a really good design and we're supportive of it. We got every single adjacent neighbor to us, except one, to not only not oppose it, but to actually write a letter of support. Spent time building that, went through the whole planning commission process, got appealed, won the appeal, went back, went through staff, got that approved, and we thought we were home free. And in fact, the city said, yeah, you're going to be able to get permits soon. And so they issued us a demolition permit. So we tore down those homes, which was 10 bedrooms between those homes. And then about a week and a half after we had finished demolition, another board, which I didn't even know existed, this thing called the Board of Adjustments, came in. And even though they have no training in historic measures, even though staff had signed off on it and everything, they came in and said, not only can you not build what you're planning to build there, but you're not even allowed to rebuild the homes that you tore down. And that obviously is just patently unfair. So we now, unfortunately, are in a situation where we have to be in litigation with the city. Again, I don't want to speak for the city, but my understanding is that even the city staff is like, this was pretty patently unfair. And so I'm hopeful that we'll get through this. I think one way or another, we're going to build the home that we have. I hope that we do it in a way which is, again, through the standard process and that we don't have to do anything that is that. But at the end of the day, like, we as a community have got to get to a place where you can't just have sort of endless appeals after endless appeals. We have to make decisions and we have to, find ways to move on. And again, if we hadn't won every step along the way, I'd say, we were doing something wrong. But everyone who's reviewed this and has had any sort of understanding or training has approved it.
Yeah.
Last April, you wrote an op-ed in the Park Record. And it was about your frustration with the sort of lack of a new development agreement between the resort and the city. Why hasn't – and first of all, let's talk a little bit about that. Yeah. Why do you think the development agreement, which is old, why is it hindering the ability of the resort to live up to what it could be?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, again, if we're in a process where any person in town can stop – lifts from being installed literally because they think the lift lines are too long, like something is broken, right? And anyone who doesn't see that's broken, like that we have to fix. And so if you're the resort, it's really difficult to make investments unless you have some sort of an agreement that says this is what's allowed. And the development agreement that exists was negotiated quite some time back. It was right when Powder Corporation, when the Cummings took over. It was actually right when I was a ski instructor. that's how long ago it was. In fact, my year was the first year the Cummings owned the resort. It's the first year snowboarding was allowed at the resort as well. The gondola was still in. Silver Load was a brand new lift, which is terrifying if you ride that lift today. And so that agreement has just gotten really long in the tooth. And people say, like, I care enormously about the town lift getting upgraded because I literally waste 3 days worth of skiing riding that lift every single year. That I ski quite a bit. I sneak out for an hour at lunch and do emails on that lift, but it's 22 minutes long. And that's just painful. And there's no reason it shouldn't be that. But when you talk to even Vail, they'll say, and Powder before it, they'll say, we don't have the right to upgrade any of this infrastructure without an upgrade in the master development agreement. And for a while, I thought that was the problem. And I still think it's a problem. I think that the city council, and I think whoever is the next mayor, as I am picking who I'm going to vote for as mayor, I'm going to pick for not who's going to set up yet another committee. We have plenty of committees in Park City. We don't need another committee. What we need is someone with vision. It doesn't have to be my vision. It could be anyone's vision. Just any vision would do. And who's actually going to get stuff done. And right now, a lot of the reason that we haven't had investment in Park City, even the reason we haven't had investment in the Deer Valley side of Deer Valley, is because the city is just ground to a halt in terms of getting things done. I think that's part of the story. Over the course of the last year, I think I was trying to, you know, give Vail a little bit of cover because it's easy to pick on Vail. I have lost faith that Vail is the right organization to be running this mountain, unfortunately. And I'm quite discouraged and have engaged in conversations with them. And I just don't see – I see them having largely given up on Park City. And that's really sad for a mountain that I care enormously about.
Yeah. Yeah, your childhood mountain.
Do you see a possibility of a change of ownership? Is anybody going to be able to come in and buy it?
I tried.
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, I reached out, and that offer still stands, and it would not be hard.
We hope you're listening, Vail. That offer still stands.
Oh, and again, I think Vail actually, to their credit, engaged. I think they've got some real challenges right now. One is, you know, Rob Katz, had a really tragic passing of his wife, and has been somewhat disengaged from that. And again, I think that they've got a little bit of a leadership vacuum. But you've got what is effectively a $5 billion corporation that has way more than $5 billion of assets in land that they own. And so if, you know, in my private equity friends would say, this is a perfect example of somewhere where you should be splitting these up, figure it out. And again, there, you could create some sort of thing that still said, you know, sure, we'll let Epic Pass holders ski here sometimes. Maybe it's not all you can eat. Maybe it's something closer to what Deer Valley does with the Icon Pass. But you could give them that benefit. And in the same way that, you know, Coca-Cola or Pepsi, you know, when interest rates go up, they sell off all their bottlers. And when interest rates go down, they buy them back. Or McDonald's sells off all of their, franchises and then buys them back when money is cheap. This feels like it is one of these things that has to be inevitable. So I think it's very unlikely that I own Park City in the next 5 years. But you know, in the next 50?
Or that somebody does.
Yeah, but I think having local owners really matters.
And that was something we really missed. Say what you want about the Cummings, but
no, the Cummings were absolute, and they are still treasures to this community.
Absolutely.
And again, I think the core problem that Vail has is what happened to the Cummings feels just unfair at some way. It just doesn't feel right, and there are certain people who are never going to be able to get over that. And I think that has just created this ill will that's going to be very, very difficult for Vail to escape.
And of course, compounding it with other sort of public relations debacles, like the way the Christmas strike was handled. I mean, you know.
But that's the problem. Like if it was local ownership, and you weren't a public company, and you had I literally don't have any interest. I don't care about making any more money. I just want to serve this community. And I can't, like, the most important thing that you could do for this community is get local owners to own this and then also get better food in town. But that's another story.
Which we could get to. Other projects you're considering here in town?
You know, I think news broke last week about the fact that we bought the Townlift Plaza.
From
the Sweeneys. And I've gotten to know the Sweeneys over the years. Pat, I think at first was quite distrustful. You know, who's this person who came into town? But we've just sat down, and I think that there's no family in town that has done more for building and preserving Park City than the Sweeneys. Pat and Mike, their dad was really kind of has his fingerprints on getting United Park City Mines to start Park City Ski Resort. When that helped get Royal Street started and get Deer Valley started, has done just a ton. You know, even going back, everyone thinks of Treasure Hill as one big parcel that the city bought. Before they bought the big parcel, Pat actually, their family basically donated 40 acres in exchange to say, we won't develop this, but we want sort of rights on these 8 lots that are up there. And it's just been amazing to talk to Pat. And when Pat said, you know, we need somebody who is going to continue the legacy, you know, I'm really I'm really touched that he reached out to us and said we would really think of you as sort of the ideal owner for that. And again, our priority is how do we make sure that the town lift becomes sort of a central hub to bring business into Main Street and to get people who are staying and living on Main Street and in Old Town up and skiing on the mountain faster than ever before.
Agreed.
And it sounds like one of the things you'd like to do is facilitate a better lift.
Totally. But again, let's think big.
Yeah.
Like, why stop at Park City? Mm-hmm. You can, with a fairly clear right-of-way, go straight from Main Street, Park City, in the same length of time, 22 minutes, same length of time that it takes to ride the town lift today, all the way to Alta with a stop in Solitude along the way. How amazing would that be? Could we make this like Europe? We need people with real vision who are going to actually make Park City the world-class city that it should be. And if I think about what's the core problem with the city, I don't think we know what we want to be. I don't think we have any idea. Like, love it or hate it, Aspen knows what it wants to be. Love it or hate it, Jackson knows what it wants to be. Love it or hate it, Sun Valley knows what it wants to be. What does Park City want to be? And that's the question that I'm going to be asking anyone who's running for mayor here. And I think they have to clearly articulate, this is what we want Park City to be. And the answer can't be, oh, I want it to be like it was yesterday. Like, I was here yesterday. The lines in the 70s and 80s, they sucked. Like, I remember standing at Thane's being like, single, like, can you let me on? Like, it was 2 hours. I mean, there used to be Prospector and Lost Proctor or Silverload where two double chairlifts. I get more vertical feet in an hour of skiing over lunch as a public company CEO than I did in a week as a kid here. So the world has gotten better, not worse. Let's celebrate that, and let's keep making it better.
Love it. Love it.
Two more things I want to try to cover in the little remaining time we have. Philanthropic philosophy. What's your philanthropic philosophy?
I mean, I want to support the local communities that we're in. So, you know, the Park Record, first newspaper I ever saw my name in as a kid, which is like one of these moments you remember. And it was dying. They'd laid off almost all their staff. It was a really sad state. And so we went in and we said, like, is there some way we could buy it? Ogden Media, who's actually a really good manager, was, you know, they said, we don't sell papers, but we believe local ownership matters. And we think you guys can do a good job. And they've been incredible partners to us. And we went in and we said, listen, we're not trying to make money. We have zero influence over what is in the paper. Don, who's our editor, has been just, I think, absolutely terrific, incredible person to the community. He will sometimes text me and say, hey, I packed the Subaru because you're not going to like what's in the paper tomorrow. But and I'll be like, what is it? And he's like, you'll see. And again, I think that that's the right thing. And so why do we do that? We do that because, you know, we want to support local news. And with KPCW, like, there's been this animosity in the past between KPCW and Park Record. And I'm like, why? We're both serving the same community. And so I said, we should, anything that KPCW wants, we should share it with them. We should do anything we want. This is such an incredible asset to this community. We should be supporting it in any way we can. And so, again, most of the, we try and do any of the giving that we do relatively quietly. We try and support great organizations. People's Health Clinic, is one of the organizations. We've done a lot to try and invest behind low-income housing. I mean, it's I very wealthy now, was dirt poor before. I know how hard it is to figure out how to pay rent here. And that was even to my dad, who charged me pretty cheap rent. And so, like, this is a place that doesn't function unless we have really great people who are able to live and work here. And so those are the things that we try and support.
I understand you're going to chair the tech committee of the Salt Lake Olympic Organizing Committee. What is that? What do you hope to accomplish?
Yeah, first of all, I was here in 2002. And for anyone who's skeptical of the Olympics is just magical. It's so much fun. Like, and I am super privileged to have been able to attend a number of Olympics over the year. Most recently, the IOC actually reached out to Cloudflare with some pretty significant security concerns that they had, not so much around the Paris Games, but actually around the youth winter sports games, which were being held in Korea. And the North Koreans were not being allowed to come, and so they were launching fairly significant cyber attacks to try and shut them down. If you think about it, the Olympics is one of the few true global organizations that's trusted. And nations like North Korea, nations like Russia, that have sort of been excluded from that global order are doing everything they can to undercut it in various ways. And so we stepped in and offered our services pro bono to them to stop that. We continued to offer it through Paris. We actually helped identify, if you remember, there were some terrorist attacks on the transportation system. We were tracking some of the cell phones that the terrorists were using and helped identify that to law enforcement, and were able to significantly mitigate that attack. And so one of the most fun things, I thought, my wife didn't agree because she gave birth basically a week before, or essentially on the day of the opening ceremony, and then the president of the IOC said, hey, I would really love for you and your co-founder to come to the Olympics. And my wife was like, you can't say no to this. You got to go. And wow. So I went. That would have been fine. I got COVID while I was there, which was not the best. But we had so much fun. It was just so great. And anyone who's going to be here in 2034, it's just going to be a magical experience. And you should be looking forward to it. And so I was incredibly honored when Fraser Bullock, who I've gotten to know, invited me to not only be on the steering committee as part of the organizing committee for the Olympics, but also chair the technology committee. I had no idea. For a games, the technology budget, excluding broadcast, is $500 million. And it's all done in a completely backwards way, where what happens basically is the marketing team at the IOC or the organizing committee will go out and pitch a bunch of people like, you know, McDonald's and Visa, but also big tech firms, to say, hey, we would love you to be a sponsor. And then after they're a sponsor, they basically say, okay, now here's the technology you have to use. That is not a way to do an IT project, right? You're not picking the right technology necessarily for the project. You're not kind of fitting it the right way. And already somebody, if they're billing for a project, they already are trying to figure out how do we make up for what we've just spent on the marketing side of this. And so we have, as a technology committee, actually got to work much earlier than the rest of it to say, how can we actually flip the model? How can we say, let's pick the best technology that we need? Let's ask them to say, listen, this is one of the few global organizations that people care about in the world. And you, as a global organization, as a technology company, you should be supporting this as well. So give us a deal. Like, make this accessible. And again, Salt Lake's going to be fine. Like, we've got the venues, we've got the budget, we've got one of the largest media markets in the world. But I'm really worried about, like, what happens to small markets, and will mm-hmm. you be able to host winter games in those small markets anymore, or even summer games? Will anyone bid for it? 2030 and 2034, Salt Lake was the only bidder for those two games, and it was France that stepped in to do 30 at the last minute. But that's, I think, going to get harder and harder and harder unless we can find ways to get costs under control. And technology feels like one of the places that's – so I hope we bring the most amazing technology to the games. I hope we are able to save Salt Lake money and budget. But really what I hope is that we can set a great example to support the Olympic movement for the long term.
Now, are you going to propose an idea for 2034 that could be used earlier?
You know, yes, if it works. I mean, these things mm-hmm. are – it's hard because of how these sort of intertwined marketing agreements work. You know, part of the reason why, 34 was more interesting than 30 was based on like when the NBC renewal was. And so having learned now a lot about this, it's pretty complicated. But I do think that if we can figure out, like, how can we do, like, here's an example. I know that you worked in production in the past. The Olympics is one of the very few places left where production is still done on site. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, if you go to an NBA game, if you watch an NBA game on TV, if you watch F1 on TV, if you watch, you know, a football team, most of those signals from all the cameras that are there are sent back to Connecticut, literally, and then they edit it all there, and then they produce it, and they send it back out. And the advantage of that is you can have people who are experts who live there and get to go home and sleep with their eat with their family and do all those things, and they don't have to travel. And that is just the way that modern production is done. The Olympics sets up literally a production booth mm-hmm. at every venue, mm-hmm. which means that you not only have to replicate a studio effectively at all those places, but you've got to get the staff from all those places back to those various locations, which means there's just this incredible expense. So again, I think that there are ways that we can modernize how we do a lot of different things. And that, by the way, that's not part of the $500 million budget. Like that's production. That's a whole different thing. Like it is remarkable that, again, I think that there are ways that we can put on an incredible games and immersive games. I think NBC with Paris did such a great job, but bring new technology to it, but do it in a way which is much more cost effective.
Yeah. Yeah. Last item. Sundance is leaving. Can it be replaced? What do you see? You have such a vision on Park City. What do you see for the future of other festivals? I heard within a month there were 100 festivals who were trying to jump in there. I don't know if I just heard it or.
Yeah, you know, I think so. So first of all, I mean, back when I was a ski instructor, my best way of getting tips was I'd get Sundance tickets and hand them out to the parents, the kids that I would be like, hey, you want to see a movie tonight? And you'd hand out the tickets to them. And so I've been going to Sundance back from the days when like I was having to sneak in the back of, you know, the CAA party and various things. And so like I have a real love of Sundance and have gotten to know a lot of the people who are involved in it, you know, over the years. And you know, I think that a lot of the general conception is that that COVID killed Sundance. I think it died long before that. And not to pile on, but I think who killed Sundance is Vail. And Altera, by the way. For a long time, like with all due respect to the Cummings and the Badamis before that, and they just didn't have the same level of sophistication in like making sure that guests were on the mountain. And so Roger, I heard you say the other day that you know, the best time to go skiing was during Sundance. That used to be true.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't been true for quite some time. And the reason why is that the resorts got smart and they realized they make nothing when their hotel room is filled with a film goer and they make a lot when a hotel room is filled with a skier. And so the minute that they figured out when the Sundance, dates were, they would send the best offers to fill all of their hotel rooms and fill the slopes with skiers during that time. And what that did, and Sundance was like, it's so strange. We used to have so many places to stay in town and it's gotten so much more expensive that we basically, the ski resorts crowded them out. And that is a totally irrational thing for them as a business to do. And I don't blame them at all. And Sundance, I mean, I back before Sundance was Sundance, it was the United States Film Festival. It was a marketing gimmick to get people to come skiing during a quiet week. I was a kid holding up the sign outside the Egyptian that said free movies, right? It was like that made sense at a period of time. They moved, it used to, if you remember, it used to conflict with Martin Luther King Day. And it was a huge negotiation to get Sundance to move off of Martin Luther King Day. And so what I advocated for, which I think would have made all the sense in the world, was that I originally thought Sundance should move to the fall. But talking to filmmakers, talking to buyers, they said it can't be that late in the season. If it's that late in the season, what it will become is the place where people launch films to get an Academy Award. And Sundance has a special place. And I think that is actually right. And so I said, actually, you know, instead, Sundance should be, let's put it in April. Like, imagine it was at the end of the ski season. There's no one here, right? Mm-hmm. The resorts would go from active adversaries to Sundance's best friends. They would want them to be here. And if you looked at the film calendar, like I met with Reed Hastings. I met with the acquisition team at Apple. I met with all of the major film studios. I met with CAA. And I said, is this better or worse? And they said, oh my gosh, it'd be so much better. Because the natural rhythm of making film is you propose it in the spring, you shoot in the summer, you edit through the fall and into the winter. And the problem is we're always submitting these rough cuts that aren't done
To Sundance.
Yeah.
And if we just had a few, like a couple more months, it would be so much better off. What was incredibly discouraging to me is I would get back this response that was like, we hired, and I can't remember if it was McKinsey or Bain, but we hired one of these big like management consultant firms, Sundance did, in order to like study this. And I would talk to the people at Sundance and they say the one thing that the management consultant firm said is we can't move the dates. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, can I read the report? So I read the report. And eventually I called the partner that was responsible for it. And I was like, okay, so what was behind this? And they said, well, the very first things that they had when they had the RFP, the first bullet was, we can't move the dates. So it was literally circular. And it drove me completely bonkers. So the right solution was to move it to April. The fact that it's left, I'm sad about. But I think there are going to be a couple of silver linings. The first, I actually think it's the thing that's going to save Main Street. Like, if we're all totally honest, Main Street is not as great as it could be, right? There's too much that is just set up to be there just so it can get rented out for the rest of the time that's here. The fact that Jim Tozer keeps the Gateway Center completely unoccupied, right, just so he can rent it during Sundance and take a tax write-off the rest of the year. Like, I find that actually really troubling as a resident in town. Like, we should have more great restaurants. We should have more. Like, the fact that the bar under the Claim Jumper, beautiful, full-fledged bar, isn't open except during Sundance. The fact that the Marquee is sort of pretend open. It's just a hole in the center of Main Street, but they can make back all their money during Sundance. Like, that has been the thing that I think has at some level held this town back. And so while I will miss Sundance, I think that we are in for a little bit of a commercial crash. But what I'll do is invest. Mm-hmm. And we will invest in this town. And again, what my wife and I plan to do is take great commercial real estate place and give it to hot young chefs and say, bring great food to Park City. Because again, I'm not here to make money off this place, but I do think that being able to have a great place where I and my friends can go out to dinner and have a great meal and meet our other friends who are in town and walk to dinner, like, that's what a good life looks like, and that's what we're trying to create.
Yeah. We've been lucky to spend the last few minutes with Matthew Prince. We so appreciate you giving us this much time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. And again,
thank
KPCW
you so
is such a resource to this community. And so much of the great music that I find myself listening to, I discovered because of this station. So thank you so much for all you do.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.